rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, podcasting also now from Apple's iTunes and WhiteRoseSociety.org. Welcome to our program. Joe Wilson, is he closer to his dream coming true?
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
And Joe Wilson, of course, being a lifelong diplomat, not a man who throws names out just capriciously.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
Now, this was over 2 years ago that Joe Wilson said that. What did George Bush have to say about it? That there might be a traitor in the White House? That there might be a traitor in his... As referred to, his father referred to this person as a traitor. Actually, in the more abstract, prior to that, George Bush Sr. saying anybody who outs a CIA agent is committing a despicable act of treason. Who is responsible for the treason in the White House? Who's the senior administration official, George Jr.?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
I don't have any idea, says George W. Well, it seems that America's starting to get an idea who it might be. And it looks like it's Karl Rove. And in fact, I'll tell you, the Republican, the right-wing machine has gone on the attack, as they always do. Questions come up about George Bush's service career. Attack John Kerry! What, George Bush, did he get out of the National Guard? Did he use the National Guard as getting out of the war? But John Kerry, John Kerry must be a scumbag traitor. Swift boats for truth. There, I guarantee you, today, on the right-wing talk shows, is going to be a day of character assassination against Joe Wilson, because they are going to try and change the subject as fast as they can. With us today, Jim Moore. He's the author of Bush's Brain, a documentary that introduces the country to Karl Rove, and is based on the best-selling book Bush's Brain by James Moore and, but also Jim Moore, and Wayne Slater. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. How do folks, first of all, this is the Bush's Brain documentary that I saw this on TV a month or so ago, but I don't recall what channel it was playing on or how do people access your documentary?
Well, it's available in all of the Blockbusters and Hollywood Videos. It can be purchased online at Amazon, and it's showing on the Sundance Channel this month.
That must be where I saw it then.
Okay,
the Sundance Channel. Great, and people can pick it up, and like you said, they can buy it on Amazon or at bookstores or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I'm always reminding people that I have a daughter who's going to college and I need to pay out-of-state tuition, so buy the book, buy the DVD.
There you go. Jim, what's your take on what's happening here? First of all, this is not the first time that Karl Rove and Bob Novak have gotten together to commit a crime, is it not?
No, actually, I don't know whether a crime was committed, but in the first presidential, the second presidential campaign of George H.W. Bush, Karl was a direct mail fundraiser here in Texas for that campaign.
Now, this is when George Bush Sr. was running against Bill Clinton for the first time.
That's correct. That's correct. And what happened was, the campaign manager for Texas, a guy named Rob Mosbacher Jr., spent $500,000 of fundraising money with Karl, but $1.5 million with another firm, and Karl was a little jacked up about it, so he started coming to a bunch of us in the Texas press corps and telling us the campaign was in a state of disarray, et cetera, to try to do something vindictive against Mosbacher, who's running the campaign. Well, we didn't write the story because we knew it not to be true, but a few weeks later, a column to that effect appeared in Robert Novak's column in the Chicago Tribune and in his syndicate, and it said that the Texas campaign was in a state of disarray, and George Bush got together, George H.W. got together with Mosbacher and U.S. Senator Phil Graham, and they sat there and said, now, who would have leaked this to Robert Novak? And they all concluded, as most of us in America have concluded, that it would have been Karl Rove, and they fired Rove for doing the leak. So there's a precedent and there's a pathology that's been there before.
And how then can George Bush Jr. come before America and say, oh, I don't have any idea. I have no idea. There's a big administration. There's a lot of senior officials. I have no idea. You know, when this guy, Karl Rove, was fired by his father for doing the exact same thing.
It's a good question, but I think you have to remember, Tom, that this president right now is not just protecting Carl, he's protecting himself, because without Carl, he's not president. He doesn't even exist. And if Carl goes down, then the Bush administration's only chance for any kind of legacy with Social Security reform, tort reform, or anything else is out the door, and the chances of Republican realignment, of resuming the power acquisition that they have done in Congress over the past 6 years, would also fall by the wayside, because with Carl out of the loop, that means that all of the plans that he's got in place to elect more members of Congress in 06, the fundraising plans he's got in place, and all of the efforts to get the Bush legislation through Congress are all going to blow up, and Bush just can't have that. It would be the ultimate form of surrender. It would mean, okay, my administration is done. There's nothing else I can do, and they can't get to that point.
Now, Jim Moore, the author of Bush's Brain, that I just have to say that sounds hyperbolic. How can Karl Rove be so essential that if he goes away, the whole Bush administration goes down the tube? Certainly, he's not the only smart guy in Washington, D.C. Or is it that he's the only sociopath? I mean, what is it about him
He is the master of all things Bush, and he is the master of all the details. If you just go back, Tom, to the reelection race, and it was Carl who gathered up all of the church directories and put them in a database, and it was Carl who developed the 72-hour get-out-the-vote plan. It was Carl who made sure that there were hundreds of millions of dollars. And now, I'm not suggesting to you that there aren't other people who aren't capable and that the Bush administration couldn't function. It will be able to function, but it will not function on the current level with the current power that it has if it loses Karl Rove. And the president, if he survives, would be a seriously wounded creature to do so.
But isn't he going to be wounded by this anyway?
Well, that's the point that we're heading to, Tom. Where we're getting on this is that we're going to get to a point where the president and his party are going to have to make a decision, because the media is not going to go away. They have been lapdogs for 5 years, and now there is evidence on camera that they were lied to, and there's nothing that animates the media like having proof that they've been lied to. So they're not going to drop this, and as long as this lingers, the more damage it does. And I think that the president and the Republicans will reach a point where they will have to say, okay, maybe we don't fire Carl, but we've got to do something. And in that case, my suspicion is that the president would move him out of the White House and over to the RNC, so the White House isn't getting the body blows of the political damage, but still has access to the brain of Mr. Rove.
Yeah, so they end up with the best of both worlds. Now, it looks to me, based on the talking points that I received in email this morning about 3 hours ago from the RNC, in fact, exactly 3 hours ago from the RNC, which was basically they were forwarding the Wall Street Journal lead editorial today, along with points that it makes, that they're reinventing Karl Rove, and they're working very, very aggressively to do this. Newt Gingrich on Good Morning America today, I believe it was, or the Today Show, one of the big network shows. And I mean, these guys are all over the place right now. They're reinventing Karl Rove as a whistleblower, and they're reinventing Joe Wilson as a guy who is trying to spread lies in the media. Are they going to get away with it?
I don't think so, although I have to tell you it's kind of interesting to see this, because I guarantee you that it's Carl who came up with this plan.
Yeah.
And it's Carl who developed the talking points and told Ken Melman and Newt Gingrich and the rest of his surrogates what to say and how to say it and where to go say it, and he is the master of positioning and framing discussions. But in this particular case, I mean, regardless of whether the law has been violated or not, what we're looking at in this case is an ethical issue, and that is that the president has said that he would not tolerate someone in his office talking about a CIA agent while we are engaged in warfare. And they're not going to be able to make that go away, because Carl has admitted that he did talk about Joe Wilson and Joe Wilson's wife. Whether he named her or not, at this point would seem irrelevant. He has done something that is unethical and the extreme interpretation is treasonous. And the president has made a promise to act on that. And I think it's fair for the public to demand that the president hold himself to his own standards.
Jim, let's take a couple of quick calls on this. Jerry in Kansas, in a truck.
Yes,
here, Jerry.
Yes, I am in a truck. I'm going across Kansas. If Carl Rove gets fired, goes home to wherever USA, and all that, I still say that I'm sure Bush will somehow or another be able to keep him on a payroll and still be able to get the same kind of advice, just in other forms, instead of sitting across the table from him. It may be by phone or mail or whatever, but I don't think this is going to, in other words, it's not like they're going to quit talking to each other.
Yeah, good point. You know, good point, Jerry. I mean, isn't that what happened? And thank you for calling in, Jerry. Isn't that what happened with Karen Hughes? I mean, Karen Hughes wanted to go back to Texas. George really needed her services. She was a long-distance advisor.
Yeah, that was really Karen doing a marketing move, though, for her book. And she's hardly here in Austin. She spends most of her time in Washington or on the road. She's here on weekends, and she's involved in her Sunday school and stuff. But I think that was a marketing move. She was a bit worn out, and she doesn't like dealing with it, and she wants to be the president's big time advisor.
Okay, so Carl may do that too. Logan in New York City has a question for you, Jim.
Sure. Yeah, I was wondering what extent is this scandal a red herring for hiding something else? It just seems like Rove is too smart for something like this.
Yeah, they're like hiding the fact that they lied us into a war. Thank you, Logan.
Well, there's a theory going around that he's protecting the president, that the president was aware of this, and that there's somebody else that this is classic misdirect and obfuscation by Rove, that he wouldn't have given Matt Cooper permission to testify or to turn over his emails if it weren't for the fact that he was protecting someone else.
I think he gave him permission because he wanted the story to stop. I think that Judith Miller by going to jail is what blew this whole thing up. If she had just turned over her notes, then it would all be quiet. It would be in a grand jury right now.
Well, we do know that Carl was not the original target of the investigation. He did not get a target letter. And if he got a target letter and his attorney let him go before the grand jury, then he's one of the worst attorneys in the history of defense law. So he wasn't a target. I think what's happened, though, is that Carl testified before that grand jury in October of 2003, and he told that grand jury that he did not speak to reporters about Valerie Plame until after Novak published, and it turned out that Matt Cooper's emails give lie to that, so there's a chance Carl perjured himself, and I think that might be what the prosecutor's going after.
Fascinating. Jim Moore, the author of Bush's Brain, a video documentary, and the best-selling book Bush's Brain by Jim Moore and Wayne Slater. Jim, thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Keep up the great work. Keep the word out there. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And just because he said that there was weapons hidden under pigsties over there, just because my boy may never make it home again, don't care.
Oh, you tell him, Patsy. He's a compassionate conservative.
If you ask me why I still believe him, after being lied to 40 times, I'll give anyone
Learn on the job still ain't no crime. Come on, give George a break. Yeah.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
See, now this is the real issue. This is the real issue. George Bush was running around saying, we've got to invade Iraq. We know now that back in 1999, before he was even running for president, he told the guy who was writing his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, the original author of the book, A Charge to Keep, by George W. Bush, the guy who was ghostwriting his autobiography, that he told him, George W. Bush told this guy, that if he became president and he had a chance to attack Iraq, he wouldn't make the mistake his father made. That he would take it all the way to Baghdad, he would take out Saddam Hussein, and he would gain enough political capital from being a wartime president that he could then take the House and the Senate for the Republicans. He would get himself reelected 4 years later. He would have political capital to spend to get his agenda done. And in fact, that's what he told us right after the election in 2004. I've got political capital, I'm going to spend it. But the only way he could get that political capital was to have a war. Because the Afghanistan war was over too quickly. The Taliban just folded up. Boing. They're gone. And going after Saddam Hussein, or Osama bin Laden, see, he's got me doing it. Going after Osama bin Laden, that's hard work. And besides that, it might be embarrassing work, since Osama bin Laden's half-brother, Salim bin Laden, is the guy who bailed George W. Bush's business out, Harkin Energy, bailed him, or Armbusto Oil Company, bailed him out when his oil company was failing 20 years ago. So, you know, all the secrets of the bin Laden Bush family, well, they're not really secrets. I mean, this has been in the New York Times, but nonetheless, all that stuff would get aired in the media again, and that wouldn't be all that comfortable. So let's forget about Osama bin Laden. Let's just not think about him quite so much. And let's instead go after Saddam Hussein. And sure enough, you know, as he was lying us into the war, and he was trying to tell us, it doesn't matter. Where bin Laden, he doesn't matter.
So I don't know where he is. Nor do, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, Kelly, to be honest with you.
Yeah, just don't spend that much time on him. I don't know where bin Laden is. And Bush says he decided to go to Iraq. Or the American people. No, actually, he decided. Not the American. Well, was it the American people? Well,
Osama bin Laden doesn't get to decide. The American people decide. I decided. The right action was in Iraq.
Yeah, see, there. This is the bottom line here. Iraq has nukes.
The evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists, a group he calls his nuclear mujahideen, his nuclear holy warriors.
And see, Joe Wilson was blowing this story up. Joe Wilson was coming along saying, hey, Bush is lying to you guys. He's lying to you. So to cover up Bush's lies about the war that he was promoting in order to gain political capital, I really don't think he expected 1,700 American soldiers would die. You know, to his, it chokes me to say it, to his credit. I really think that he was right about the invasion, right? It was successful. It was short. He just had no idea that there would be an occupation. He can't think that far ahead. And now here we have this terrible mess.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, give me shelter. Give me shelter from Karl Rove. It's, you know, what's, holy cow, what's going on with us? Welcome back. John Ashcroft, December 14th, 2001. Leaks of classified information do substantial damage to the security interests of this nation. He actually created a task force to investigate government leaks. Somehow I suspect a task force invented within the Bush administration wouldn't go very far. George Bush Sr., April 26, 1999. I have nothing but contempt and anger for those who betray the trust by exposing the names of our sources. They are, in my view, the most insidious of traitors. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer. This right after Karl Rove leaked this information. Apparently Karl Rove. I think we can safely say now, right after Karl Rove leaked this information. Ari Fleischer. The president does have very deep concerns about anything that would be inappropriately leaked that could in any way endanger America's ability to gather intelligence information, and even that could harm our ability to maintain sources and methods, and anything that could interfere with America's ability to fight the war on terrorism. Right. And now, I'm telling you, the strategy, the absolute strategy now is going to be make Karl Rove into a saint. Karl Rove is the whistleblower. These are the RNC talking points, probably written by Karl Rove, as Jim Moore just pointed out. Make Karl Rove a saint. He was a whistleblower. He was trying to tell us that Joe Wilson was lying to us when Joe Wilson told us that George Bush was lying to us. But if you go back and look, you discover that, in fact, it was George Bush who was lying to us. And that's the thing that nobody's talking about, is that what's really going on here is that Bush lied us into a war, Joe Wilson outed him for that, Karl Rove came down on Wilson for that, and nobody is discussing. Nobody. I don't even, on the left, I don't even hear people talking. It stops at the door of Karl Rove. It's like, oh, Karl Rove's the bad guy. I'm sorry, Karl Rove was carrying water for George W. Bush Jr. This was all about Jr. lying us into a war so he could get political capital. Not to mention a little oil and a few billion dollars for his buddies in the defense industry. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Our chat room you can get to by going to TomHartmann.com and clicking on live chat. Kodak in North Carolina driving a truck. Hey, Kodak, what's up?
Yes, you just made the point I wanted to comment on, Tom, is the fact that I think we are losing sight of the purpose of this whole thing in view of the Downing Street memo. Actually, the focus should be on the fact that Bush lied and, as you just said, lied us into a war. And this will be the perfect opportunity to tie the lie in to the consequences, and we also now have the proof.
Right.
And maybe that is what Karl Rove is trying to divert our attention away from, the fact that the Downing Street memo is really incriminating.
Yeah, to the extent that Karl Rove is willing to fall on his sword, it looks like that might be happening. I agree with you that he's doing it to protect George W. Bush and his legacy and the Republicans in general and the whole war machine in general, basically to say, hey, not to worry. Yes, we lied you into a war, but no, we didn't lie you into a war.
Right.
Yes, we have a war, but no, we didn't lie you into it.
Yeah.
They're trying to cover up the big lie here.
Yeah, and Downing Street memo now has just disappeared from the face of the earth.
Right, right.
As far as the news cycle goes.
Yeah, and which is, you know, making these guys very, very happy.
Yes, exactly.
Good point. Yes, Kodak.
What is Karl Rove's nickname that was given to him by George Bush?
I don't recall. Do you know?
No, I heard it earlier this morning because they were using that and linking it with the word gate as this new scandal. Toad pudding, flower child, something. I can't remember now.
I'm sorry, I don't remember either. Kodak, right, perhaps one of our listeners will know, or maybe somebody in the chat room will know and post it. Scott in Richmond, Virginia on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Tom Hartmann program. What's up?
The answer is...
You're kidding.
No, that's his nickname, Turd Blossom. It's a Texas...
Okay, I'm dumping these things out here, Scott. I'm not sure I can put that on the air, but...
I'm sorry, but that's what it is.
Okay.
The president called it on the air.
All righty. Interesting.
What I called about, Tom.
Yeah.
Have you read the Opinion Journal article today of how Karl Rove is really a true patriot and a hero for being a whistleblower?
Yeah, this is the lead editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and the Republican National Committee, the RNC, just emailed it out to all the talk show hosts in America 3 hours and 20 minutes ago.
Have they no shame?
I'm telling you, they're reinventing this thing. The Republican strategy is when on the defense, go on the attack. When it started coming out that George W. Bush had a less than creditable service record, for example, that he had evaded service, that he had, as a friend of his father, got him into the Champaign unit of the Texas Air National Guard, and then he went AWOL, and then he deserted. When that came out, what did they do? Did they try to defend it? Did they try to justify it? No, they attacked John Kerry for not being a patriot. And now when it comes out that Joe Wilson was outing George W. Bush for lying to us about a war, and Karl Rove tried to bring him down for doing it and warn anybody else, don't mess with us, they're gonna flip it around and turn Karl Rove into a hero. And I'm predicting it'll stick. I'm predicting that within 2 weeks, many Americans, certainly the majority of Republicans, and everybody who watches Fox News, is going to believe Karl Rove was the good guy, Joe Wilson was the bad guy, and what's the big fuss about?
Well, I hope you're wrong, but
I'm wrong too.
In the near future, when the history of this administration is written, they're going to be famous for being able to take chicken poop and turn it into chicken salad.
There you go.
Because they pervert everything that comes down the pike, and just do it in their favor with unmitigated gall.
I know. It's absolutely incredible, Scott. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Frank in Easton, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Frank.
Actually, it's Spike.
Oh, Spike. Sorry.
That's okay. I'm a little bit off subject from the conversation today. I have two questions about Supreme Court nominees, actually. Is there a prerequisite that they have to be a judge at any point?
No, it's not. There are no criteria in the Constitution. The only thing the Constitution says about anybody who might become anything is that there can't be a religious test. That's the only thing that's in the Constitution.
So basically, if they attempted to make a compromise and they wanted to use someone who would be a liberal person they could put as a prop nominee, but not exactly someone the Democrats might care for, like, let's say, Ralph Nader, then they could actually nominate Ralph Nader as a Supreme Court justice.
Sure, and in fact, Ralph Nader as a lawyer is actually qualified.
Yeah, I think he's probably more qualified than most of these stooges the neocons are going to give us. And considering the Democrats haven't been doing a good job at proposing anyone as a Supreme Court nominee, he would be a good one.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, the Republicans are probably seeing him as, oh, he's a good wedge issue. You know, James Carville says, you know, the only person he hates more than Nader is Jerry Falwell. You know, this would be a great guy.
Now, it's a good point, Scott, but it's not going to happen. It wouldn't be wonderful, but there's no way they're going to put Ralph Nader in there. Ralph Nader is he's too explosive and he's too honest, by and large. I mean, I had certainly many battles with Ralph Nader and his minions when he was trying to play politician. But as a consumer advocate, he's done some really, truly great work. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Jim in Chicago on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I think the liberals need to keep their talking points real simple. Either Karl Rove lied to the president and everybody else around him and can't be trusted and asked the White House to defend against that, or they knew and Bush was lying to us and everybody else. And, you know,
and that Bush was lying to us part is being dropped by this media. You know, everybody, David Gregory of NBC News actually asked Scotty McClellan a hard question. Well, the hard question that nobody is asking, particularly NBC News, none of the mainstream media is asking. The hard question that nobody's asking is, isn't this about Karl Rove trying to protect George Bush lying about Niger and nuclear weapons, essentially lying us into a war? Isn't that what's really going on here? That is being completely lost.
Ultimately.
Yeah, and it's not even being brought up on the left, in my opinion, anywhere near enough. It's like people aren't, you know, oh, is Karl Rove, should Karl Rove go to jail? As if getting rid of Karl Rove is going to solve all the problems of the country. I'm sorry, this is not, in my mind, about Karl Rove. This is about the Bush administration, the whole bunch of them lying to us. Karl Rove being part of that machine. Maybe he was even the puppet master in the machine. Who knows? But he's part of that machine. And that machine lied to us. And that machine, in my opinion, therefore doesn't have the credibility to run this country. And George Bush should be impeached because of it.
Can the grand jury subpoena the Bolton records that everybody's looking for?
You're talking about the Fitzgerald?
Against the Roe leak.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a connection there.
Well,
I think...
I'm suspicious that there's a connection there, too. But, frankly, I don't know. And you know, whether they get around to doing that or not, time will tell. We'll just have to see. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to ask you, the right has been spinning this Valerie Plame thing, saying that she is the one who sent her husband there. That's not true, is it?
And no.
Okay, so how do you know how it works? Who sent him? Do you know?
The closest I can get to what might have happened is that she had suggested him to somebody in the CIA as somebody who could do it. But,
okay.
You know, she certainly didn't have the authority to send him.
Sure,
and,
I didn't
and,
think
so. You know, and whether... But, see, the point is that that's not even relevant.
Right, right.
What's relevant is...
There's no yellow cake.
That's right. What's relevant is that George Bush was lying to us about Saddam Hussein representing a nuclear threat to the United States of America.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that simple. It just gets right down to that. This is the beginning and the end of what's relevant.
Facing clear evidence of peril.
Yeah.
We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
That's the bottom line, Amy.
Absolutely.
And then that's what everybody is missing.
Yes.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, bye.
Good talking to you. 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, look, I heard you say a few minutes ago about predicting the American people will agree about Karl Rove being a saint or whatever. I think it's time we need to fight back. I just got into it with a bunch of Republicans just a few minutes ago about all this. And when it came down to it, and I backed them into a corner with the facts that I know against the talking points they've heard, it's down to, well, we're Republicans and we have to back these people.
That's right.
Oh, I told them point blank, and this is what we need to tell you guys. The Republican Party has been duped. They've been taken over by these neocons, and I can't understand why we as liberals do not address that more. You know, you know what I'm saying?
I do, and I absolutely agree with you. It's got to be about, our discussion always has to be about what's best for the United States of America.
Exactly.
And Republicans, please take back your party. I would love to see, you know, Eisenhower-type Republicans, Barry Goldwater-type Republicans back in the Republican Party. There's a few of them. You got Ron Paul in there. You've got, you know,
exactly.
Arlen Specter, arguably. Olympia Snow of Maine, George Voinovich. There are some good Republicans in the Republican Party. The Republican Party, however, has been hijacked by ideologues
exactly.
and neocons, and they are destroying the Republican Party and the United States in the meantime. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Rick in New Mexico in a truck. Hey, Rick.
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I take offense that you call the president a liar.
I say that again?
Clinton was a liar. Clinton was a whore.
Okay, Rick, I'll grant you that Bill Clinton lied about sex. Which is worse, lying about sex or telling a lie that leads to the death of 1,700 Americans?
Say that again. I didn't hear you.
Okay. I will agree with you that Bill Clinton lied about sex. Which is the worst lie? To lie about sex or to lie about something that causes the death of 1,700 Americans?
Clinton didn't do anything for this country in 8 years of office.
That's not what we're talking about, Rick. Which is the worst lie? To lie about sex or to lie about war? Which is the worst lie?
He's a liar. Clinton's a liar.
And
President Bush is the greatest president since Reagan.
Yeah, I'll give you that. And Reagan was the worst president we've ever had in the history of the United States. Thanks a lot, Rick. Good to hear from you. Indeed. Tony in Washington, D.C. Hey, Tony.
Hey, I'm last night.
Tony, I'm sorry. You're breaking up so badly. You got to call back on a clean line. Pat in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Pat.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Man, that last caller, Rick, that's who we're up against, unfortunately.
I know.
Quick thought about the Karl Rove deal. All the spinning in the world that the Republican Party is going to do right now, it's not going to help them, though, when the final analysis comes down to what the special prosecutor and the courts say. Am I correct on that, or will they have to attack the special prosecutor's decisions when that time comes?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, there may be legal proceedings against Karl Rove. It's looking increasingly like they're going after Rove for...
The special prosecutor and the courts... say. Am I correct on that, or will they have to attack the special prosecutor's decisions when that time comes?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, there may be legal proceedings against Karl Rove. It's looking increasingly like they're going after Rove for perjury. That Rove
right.
did the exact same thing Bill Clinton did, and that is that he committed a crime. In Clinton's case, it was, you know, getting it on with Monica. And whether or not that's a crime, that's arguable. But then they tried to cover it up. And if Rove lied to the grand jury about talking to reporters, and it seems that in his testimony he said that he did not talk to the press before Bob Novak's column was published, and yet Matt Cooper's emails give the lie to that. If that's the case, then Karl Rove is facing perjury charges identical to Bill Clinton. And then the question is, at what point did George W. Bush know about this? And when Bush said to America that he didn't know, and now Bush was under oath, he's under the oath of office, right? I mean, this is an oath as well. Was Bush lying to us when Bush said...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of...
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not from some right-wing think tank or the RNC.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, it'll all work out, my friends. Welcome back. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tomas.
Hey, first of all, hola, hola to all the people in the chat room.
There you go. Okay. So what's up?
Yeah. I think that you have to read in between your Republican talking points there. I met Karl Rove, and to me, the guy, first of all, considers himself a bodyguard for the president. He's loving this attention that you guys are giving him. You know, I mean, the more that the attention is on him, the less it's going to be a Supreme Court battle, and that's going to be a big battle.
Yeah.
You know, the less it's going to be on everything else, on the war.
On the energy bill, all the billions that are going to go to their buddies in the oil industry. You're right.
I mean, so, I'm still on the conservative side, so I think that... you got to keep that in mind because even though I'm on the third side, I think we still have to talk about the Supreme Court thing. It's going to be a very, very big battle. And Karl Rove, you know, he's just not a soldier out there. He goes down, somebody else is going to come up.
Okay, good point, Tomas. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Maybe, or it could be that he's Bush's brain. Dave in D.C. on the line. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I accidentally pushed the wrong button on my AM dial and got Rush, and I was shocked to listen for about 15 minutes of Rush talking about how Wilson had no credentials to go out and investigate about the so-called uranium deal and how that Iraq had ties to the terrorism in 9/11. And it was just, I was astounded. It was the most blatant propaganda, 180 degrees around the truth.
Oh, I know. This is. I mean, Limbaugh has always been a spokesman for the Republicans, for the corporatists, for those who want to take over this country and roll back the New Deal and let the corporations take over the country. An agenda otherwise known as fascism, and they're screwing the very people. The average working class people who think that they're helping them. Ronald Reagan passed the biggest tax increase in the history of the United States, in the 230-year history of the United States, when he doubled Social Security taxes. It only hit people making $30,000 a year or less in 1983. Ronald Reagan did that. And yet people, and the same working, and at the same time, and he did that so that he could reduce taxes on billionaires and millionaires, and that's what people remember. Oh, he cut taxes. And so you just have to remember, you know, Limbaugh is all about rolling back the New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
See, undo Social Security, undo minimum wage protections, undo unemployment insurance, undo all that stuff, and get the average working guy to think that you're on his side. That's their agenda, and now they're going to try and turn this one upside down as well. It's just absolutely incredible. It's the top of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from coast to coast, also on Sirius Satellite Radio, radiopower.org, live 365 on American FM, and whiterosesociety.org, also podcasting there, as well as on Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Andy in Springfield, Ohio, had some final thoughts. I want to kind of close out this Karl Rove thing and move along. Hey, Andy, what's up?
What's going on? So real quick, I was listening during the last commercial break. I was checking out some, like, Fox News in the talk right station on the Sirius, and they're already putting a spin on this Karl Rove thing. You know, they're saying with the attacks in London, you know, the war in Iraq, and even they bring about North Korea into this. They're like, this is all the Democrats have. This is all they have to worry about. Well, yeah, it's the leaders of our country are flat out lying to us. Yeah, we're worried about it. We're pissed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
I just want to answer is all. You know what I mean? I'm not asking for much.
Yeah.
I don't get it, but.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree, Andy. Thank you very much for the call. Karl Grossman is with us. Karl is the professor of journalism at the State University of New York College of Old Westbury. Has specialized in investigative reporting for more than 30 years. I want to move from Karl Rove being in outer space to actual outer space here. We have this launch coming up. And, in fact, it's going to be happening in about an hour and a half or two. Actually, I think it's 2 hours exactly from right now. And, Carl, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
A pleasure.
And, Carl Grossman, what is really going on with the space program? It was fascinating to me. I thought yesterday there were several people on various talking head shows on TV. And the question came up several times, why are we sending people back into outer space? And the answers seem to be, well, it's because it's the national pride at stake. It's, you know, it's going to pump up Americans. It makes us feel better about ourselves. Quack, quack, quack. And I was yelling at the TV going, no, it's they want to militarize outer space and they need the space shuttle to do it. Am I off base?
Well, in fact, the space shuttle was developed 50-50 as a civilian and a military vehicle. In fact, that's one of the big problems with the space shuttle. It was constructed by committee with a lot of colonels and generals on those committees. Well, through the years, I'm sure listeners remember missions that we didn't hear much about, several officers on the shuttle doing mapping, doing other military missions. So it is 50-50, a military and a civilian vehicle.
And what is it doing now?
Well, this shot, as far as you can tell, as far as we know, is a civilian shot. It's going to ostensibly bring some stuff up to the space station, and I was just watching the TV on this. I can't believe it's been going on for so long. The rah-rah, the cheerleading of the media to the space programming. It's just.
I think we all like the idea of explorers, you know, the noble explorer off on a mission, the kind of Star Trek, you know, searching for worlds unknown and charting new territory. There's something, you know, the heart swells at the idea of Lewis and Clark or the myth of Christopher Columbus, even though the reality is very different from the myth. Nonetheless, there's this idea of the noble explorer that I think everybody can identify with as an archetype that we all love. But you suggest that it's being exploited to nuclearize and weaponize outer space?
Well, let me explain how I got into the story, so to speak.
Sure.
In fact, way back in the early 80s, I was ready to apply to be a journalist in space. I had interviewed Neil Armstrong as a reporter when he came back from the moon. I mean, he was a very, very impressive guy. He was telling me about he was an Eagle Scout. I mentioned I was an Eagle Scout. We're talking about Eagle Scouts. And I kind of thought that this NASA was a kind of a Boy Scouty agency, which you watch the television today, you still kind of get that feeling. It's
right.
All motherhood and apple pie and so forth. And I read in 1985, this is 20 years ago, a little Department of Energy newsletter noting that two shuttle launches were being arranged for the following year, 1986, in which the shuttles, a shuttle called the Challenger, were to send up space probes with plutonium on them, deadly plutonium.
Now, let's just pause this for just a second so our listeners get it. The Department of Energy is a great euphemism, but the agency really isn't about giving us energy. The Department of Energy does what in the United States government?
Well, it's it's a promotional agency, really sandwiching in the old U.S. Atomic Energy Commission.
They run our nuclear weapons program, do they not?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's when Congress finally got itself together and ended the Atomic Energy Commission because it was supposed to somehow regulate nuclear technology and promote it at the same time. What was done was we established a Nuclear Regulatory Commission, then a few years later, a Department of Energy to promote, well, particularly to promote nuclear power. It's not a balanced agency. It doesn't promote solar particularly or wind or renewable energy, safe, clean, renewable energy. It's very much a nuclear operation.
But they also make atomic bombs.
Oh, yeah. Well, it took over all those Atomic Energy Commission laboratories, those nuclear laboratories like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge.
Right. So the agency that's making our nuclear bombs wanted to put something aboard the spaceship Challenger that contained plutonium. Plutonium is so deadly radioactive that if an ounce of it was dispersed, it would be impossible to do this, but if an ounce of it was dispersed throughout the entire planet, it would be enough to kill every human being alive. Just a few molecules of it in your lungs, and you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to get lung cancer eventually.
Yeah, well, less than a millionth of a gram is a fatal dose. And the real problem, if a particle of this thing gets into a lung, it's not readily water-soluble. It's not going to get out. It's going to leave a person with lung cancer. And I was familiar with the toxicity of plutonium because I had done at that point a book on nuclear power, in fact, called Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. It's still kicking around. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Energy and also NASA and also five national laboratories, which were said to have been involved in this scheme. And again, I had the impression from Neil Armstrong, from just being an average American, you listen to the cheerleading, that NASA was a clean-cut, kind of straight agency. I mean, it was set up in 1958 ostensibly as a civilian agency to pursue what many feel is the ultimate destiny of humanity, space. So I sent a Freedom of Information Act request asking what would be the consequences if one of these shuttles blew up on launch or in the lower atmosphere, the upper atmosphere. And I figured I'd get in a few days back some information under the Freedom of Information Act, considering it was NASA. I mean, it wasn't the CIA. Well, the weeks passed, the months passed. What a cover-up. I mean, I had to kick and scream, and finally, almost a year later, I got some information to the effect that, yeah, we would have a disaster if the plutonium was released, but the likelihood of a catastrophic shuttle accident was 1 in 100,000. So I teach my students investigative reporting. I tell them, don't hype things, don't exaggerate. And I didn't know what to do. I waited a couple of weeks thinking about, should I write a story? I mean, it's a 1 in 100,000 chance. That's not bad odds. And then I was driving to work to teach my investigative reporting class at SUNY. This is 1986 now, January 28th, and I'm listening to the car radio, and the Challenger blew up, and all I was thinking is, man, if it was the next mission, May of 86, when it was to have one of these plutonium-fueled space probes on it, you wouldn't have just seven brave astronauts dying. You could have had, well, that plutonium could have spread over Central Florida like the pieces of the Challenger did, and you'd have many, many more people dead. Incidentally, in a few weeks, NASA changed the odds of a catastrophic shuttle accident from 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 76. I mean, they just made up the numbers originally. And that's what got me into this story. Then I wrote a piece immediately, in fact, that day, January 28th, 86, for The Nation magazine. It appeared on its front page, the next issue, about these nuclear shots, these atomic shots. And I've been on the story ever since, both the nuclearization of space. I mean, for example, that Challenger mission was to loft the Ulysses space probe with plutonium on it to do an orbit of the sun. I mean, you can't use solar photovoltaic cells to provide the electricity, onboard electricity. You need plutonium. What do they need plutonium for? And then as I continued, I mean, I was looking who was making money on this. Turns out General Electric was building these plutonium systems then. Now it's Lockheed Martin. Looked at the national laboratories like Oak Ridge and Los Alamos, seeking to make all kind of money. And then I connected into the military connection with NASA, to wit, The U.S. then and now is looking to deploy weapons in space, hypervelocity guns, particle beams, and lasers, and so forth, to control Earth from space. They call space, the military does, and documents that I've collected, the ultimate high ground. The problem is, how are you going to energize these weapons that the U.S. would like to put up into space? Answer, nuclear power. And there then I found, like, what was pushing, and is still pushing, NASA with the Department of Energy to use nuclear technology in space. Indeed, just a year and a half ago, the Bush administration launched Project Prometheus, which is like a multi-billion dollar project to expand the use of these plutonium systems in space, and also to build, we tried this decades ago, we canceled it because of a concern of a nuclear-powered or propelled rocket crashing back to Earth, to revive the scheme of nuclear-propelled rockets. And the whole notion of weaponizing space.
And this is, and you have at the core of all of this General Electric and Lockheed Martin?
Well, yeah, yeah. The corporations are deeply embedded in this whole program.
Tell us about the Rods from God program.
Well, Rods from God, they're talking about titanium rods or rods produced with other metal alloys being shot down from space at such a velocity that they would hit with the velocity of a low grade nuclear weapon. I mean, this is in violation of the Outer Space Treaty, which the United States, let me note, was central in getting enacted. It goes back 1967. The Soviets had put up Sputnik in 57, and we in the early 60s began working with the Soviets and the British, and we got this thing, basically it's the constitution for how humanity is to deal with space, which declares that space shall be used for peaceful purposes. It prohibits, it bars things like rods from God.
But the Bush administration is still pursuing this. We've got to wrap this up. We're talking with Carl Grossman. He's a professor of journalism at the State University of New York. Carl, is there a website where people can learn more about this?
Yeah, just go to www.envirovideo.com. One word, envirovideo.com. I've done numerous television about this. A TV documentary which kind of sums it up is Star Wars Returns. And that's available through that website.
Great. Envirovideo.com. Thanks a lot. Carl Grossman with us. Thank you, Carl, for being with us and for spreading the good word. Or the bad word. It's the militarization of space. Do we really want plutonium flying over our heads? Well, that's on the agenda. If the Bush administration keeps going down the road they're going, why are we not surprised? It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA, I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. George W. Bush, New York Times, reporting that he has said that he's going to hold his comments on Roe's leak in the CIA case. He's gonna hold off, right? He's not gonna say, well, I don't know, you know, like he has in the past, right? He's not gonna go there. I'd say though, George, you've already made a comment.
And I don't know. We're gonna find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, Ellen Ratner's with us, our Washington, D.C. bureau chief. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. Actually,
thoughts on this?
What?
Thoughts on all this?
What did you say?
I said, what are your thoughts on all this?
Oh, my thoughts. thoughts on the Roe stuff? Well, it's very interesting. I mean, he has said that he's not going to comment on an ongoing investigation. Some people in Washington are reading that as he's being very Trent Lott-like about this, and that he knows his guy may be in some serious trouble, and so he is trying to not say a whole lot, but also not support him in a big way.
Hmm, interesting.
The First Lady was in Tanzania today and said that Karl Rove had been a very good friend for a number of years, and that's all she would say about it.
Right, yeah.
A couple other interesting things. One is, of course, there's the Guantanamo hearings today, and now they're saying, well, the prisoner was abused but not torture, but this is just one of them. And also, they are saying, well, you know, there's a lot of good information that's coming out of Guantanamo still. Find that hard to believe 3 years later, but we'll see. You know, the issue is, well, some of the press are coming back and say, well, you know, they're playing soccer. Well, you can play soccer, but if you don't have an attorney, what good does that do?
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting is the House hearings on China. And that is very, very interesting. And the hearings basically are saying, in terms of China, that first of all, the American companies are afraid to report when China does things, either against human rights or whatever, because they're afraid they're going to be cut off.
Hmm.
And so that...
Cut off by whom? You mean cut off by the Chinese from their supply of product?
Exactly. Or you know, not allowed to do business there.
Right. Well, it's a legitimate fear. I mean, communist China is a dictatorship. It's, you know, you lie down with dogs, you get fleas.
Well, exactly. And so there's a lot of ways that they're talking about this. And now they're saying at the hearings, well, we have about 10 or 15 more years to influence China before they are just so powerful that there's nothing we can do. Well, hello, what happened in the last 15 to 25 years?
Yeah, we have 10 or 15 years to influence China before they own us. Lock, stock, and barrel. I mean, there is the discussion. What's the frame for these hearings? Is it about the
it's about the UNICAL.
Yeah, the UNICAL,
which would be $18 billion.
Right.
And of course,
which is chump change for China.
Which is chump change for China. It is helpful to our investors here, but that's. You know, and it is not that much of the oil issue. The other thing that's coming up on these hearings is how much did the Iraq war influence this? And of course, they're saying, well, China's looking for other places for oil because they thought they were going to somehow be able to squeeze Iraq and get a lot more oil out of it.
Well, they had a deal with Saddam, didn't they?
I believe they did.
Yeah, I think China and India both had deals with Saddam, and Russia.
They build up the industry, and then of course the U.S. comes in, and who says this war isn't about oil?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, George was pretty upfront about it when he was, when he announced the war to the American people and to the Iraqi people. He then said, and now I have a message for the people of Iraq, and turned to them and said,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And everybody in Iraq went, oh, now we know what's going on.
You got it.
Yeah, okay. Ellen Radner, thanks so much for the report today from Washington, D.C.
You're welcome.
Deep in the belly of the beast. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a good one. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more after this. Your calls as well, 1-866-889-8894. I want to get into the suicide blast, by the way. Stick around.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Happy summer, my friends. Here we are in the beautiful month of July. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website. Your home for democracy, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Andy Borowitz, you notice the war of words going on between Hillary Clinton and George W. Bush? Recently, Hillary Clinton saying that George W. Bush reminds her of the character Alfred E. Newman from Mad Magazine. You wonder, was she talking about his ears or about his attitude? In any case, Andy Borowitz reports on theborowitzreport.com. Bush says he's not worried. Nice one. Not worried by being compared to Alfred E. Newman. After Senator Hillary Clinton compared him over the weekend to Mad Magazine mascot Alfred E. Newman, President Bush held a press conference today to say that he was not worried by such a comparison. All day long, he said, people have been asking me if being compared to Alfred E. Newman worries me. My response to them is, what, me worry? But even as the president claimed not to be worried by being likened to Mad's gap-toothed cover boy, he lashed out at Senator Clinton, comparing her to the character Lucy Van Pelt from the popular comic strip Peanuts. Mr. Bush said, much like Lucy, Senator Clinton is an annoying, bossy loudmouth, and she's always pulling the football away at the last second, only in her case, the football is the truth. President's comparison of Senator Clinton to Lucy did not go unanswered for long, however, as the senator's office released an official statement comparing the president to the classic Disney character Dumbo. But within minutes, Mr. Bush took time out from a conference call with Russian President Vladimir Putin to compare Senator Clinton to Sabrina the Teenage Witch, adding, only she's not a teenager. While official Washington wondered whether the war on words between the president and the senator would cease, Senator Clinton issued one final statement late in the day in which she compared herself to rubber and the president to glue. Elsewhere, hours after the new Harry Potter book was leaked 1 week early in Vancouver, White House strategist Karl Rove has denied responsibility for that leak. That from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. On a more serious note, the London bombings... The London attacks were suicide bombings, says the British Home Secretary, Charles Clarke. The New York Times reporting this now. Had been speculation about this. Mr. Clarke did not use the phrase suicide bombing, notes Alan Cowell in his column in the New York Times, but said in an interview with the BBC that European nations had to defend their values against their values of society against those who would destroy it. He said that means standing out against, in a very strong way, anyone who preaches the kind of fundamentalism, as I say, that can lead four young men to blow themselves and others up on the tube on a Thursday morning. Police are pretty sure at least one of the bombers died in the attacks, and perhaps as many as all four. They found property belonging to all four men at the scenes of the various explosions. Now, what this does, this raises a couple of very interesting points. The first is, if these were homegrown terrorists, as it appears they were, and if they are actually first-generation Brits, they're actually citizens of Great Britain, they were born in England, they speak proper British, or spoke it before they blew themselves up, then how is this all that different from Tim McVeigh? And what should our response to it be? I mean, remember, Tim McVeigh had been brainwashed by the white supremacist, fundamentalist, Protestant Christian cult, this cult within Protestant Christianity that believes that, you know, only whites are the chosen people, that the mark of Cain that's talked about in the book of Genesis, where God banned Cain for killing his brother Abel. And so Cain took off, went someplace else, where he found a wife, which is interesting, because Adam and Eve hadn't had any girls at that point. Think about that one for a minute. Anyway, that when God banished Cain, he put the mark of Cain on his forehead. And the teaching of some of these folks is that mark of Cain is a colored skin, right? And so you've got these right-wing fundamentalist Christians who are claiming the Bible. They're quoting the Bible to support a racist theology. And claiming that they have the right to dominate the world, basically, that they're God's, you know, the only chosen race. And Tim McVeigh got into this thing. He got into this cult, apparently, in 1990, 1991, when he was a soldier in the Gulf War in Iraq. Or actually in Kuwait. Bush Sr. And he became convinced by being baptized into this movement, this white supremacist movement, that is, by the way, all over the United States. You think that it's not going on near you. You're wrong. It's all over this country, these people. And he became convinced by being a part of this movement that the Jews controlled the world's money supply, and that that African Americans were controlling all the paranoid fantasies of these guys, right? This whole collection of paranoid fantasies, and that ultimately what was going to happen was that the people who secretly controlled the government, the liberals, the African Americans, the Jews, pick your list. Everybody, the Catholics, certainly, they've got no shortage of conspiracy theories about how the Pope is involved in all this. That eventually the United States government would show its true colors and show how it really was an instrument of oppression by these groups. And as such, it would, once that became obvious, then everybody would say, oh, that's what they're all about. And then all the good white Protestant Christians who have been storing guns just for that day would rise up and take back America. Because in the minds of these people, the Second Amendment was there so that if the government ever became oppressive, people would have guns, they could fight back the government. Now, first of all, that's not why the Second Amendment is there. If it was, the Second Amendment would have said, you can have cannons. I mean, that was the state of art of military warfare. You can have warships. Second Amendment was there because Jefferson and a number of others along with him believed that we should never have a standing army during time of peace. Well, if you don't have a standing army during time of peace, how do you defend the country? The way you defend the country is you make everybody a member of the militia. It's how they do it in Switzerland, among others. And if everybody's a militia, you ring the bell a certain way on the city hall or the church tower, and everybody grabs their gun out of their closet and steps out front in their house, and boom, the entire country is the army. It's why Hitler never invaded Switzerland. Every single person in Switzerland was a member of the army. Every single man in Switzerland between the ages of 17 and 47. So that was, that's why the Second Amendment came about. But I digress. So Tim McVeigh had this belief that the day would come when our government would show its true colors by being so repressive that it would cause all the good Americans to realize, okay, they've stepped over the edge. And that would bring about the clash of civilizations, the Armageddon battle, the race war, the war against all the non-white Protestant Christians. And that the people who are members of this cult within Protestant Christianity that Tim McVeigh was a member of, this white supremacist cult, which has many different faces and takes many different forms throughout this country, that they would grab their guns and step out of their houses and they would say that they were here to fight against the government and to bring it down because it had become the evil, repressive monster. And McVeigh believed when he watched the Waco, when he watched the FBI go into Waco and set that building on fire and kill those people, in his mind. And by the way, to be on the record, as it were, I think that the FBI, what they did was horrible at Waco, and that could have been resolved peacefully. And I think Janet Reno totally bungled that, and whoever was in charge of the FBI at the time, and Bill Clinton, the whole bunch of them, I think they blew it with regard to that. So anyhow, Tim McVeigh is looking at what happened in Waco and the situation that went down there, and he says, oh, this is it. This is going to be the thing that's going to trigger the uprising of good white people across America. This was in McVeigh's mind. But it didn't happen. So he says, okay, well, we got to set off a bomb. Why? Because he had read this book, The Turner Diaries. The Turner Diaries is a novel that talks about how it's actually in the novel, The Turner Diaries, that starts out with a botched robbery and ends up with this final war, this final Armageddon war. And McVeigh, this was his Bible, this book, The Turner Diaries, this novel. And in there, there's a guy, a McVeigh-type character, who's going to bring about the confrontation with the government, and he does it by blowing up a federal building. And now, it's not the blowing up of the federal building that provokes the revolution against the government. It's the response of the government to the blowing up of the federal building. In the book, the government clamps down with a Patriot Act that suppresses civil liberties. They start invading people's homes. The FBI shows up. They're wiretapping people's phones. The government becomes oppressive. And the good patriots stand up and say, we're not going to take this anymore. And boom, you've got civil war going on in the United States. That's what McVeigh thought would happen. He thought that he would blow up the federal building in Oklahoma. And the response of the government would be to become what he believed it really was, which was an oppressive force. And that when that happened, that would bring about the revolution, which would restore America to what McVeigh thought its original ideal and goal was, which was to be a white Protestant Christian nation. Okay? You got all that? Now, the guys who committed suicide and blew up all these people in London apparently thought the same thing. It was just a different race and different religion. And the reason that I can say that with some confidence is because this is nothing new. I mean, this is, if you look at you know, a lot of these conspiracy theorists in a lot of these countries, what causes people to think like this? Well, they see their country going down the road, down the wrong road, down the road of oppression, of increasing oppression, domestically as well as internationally. And they say, okay, that's it. We're about at the end. And the country has gone wrong. And it really concerns me that the way, you know, I have to say, the way that you respond to this, and this is no secret, the way you respond to this is not by, you know, lashing out, clamping down harder. If somebody's saying, hey, wait a minute, your society is not open, your society is not free, then you respond to that by saying, okay, you're in jail? No, I think that you respond to that, you know, very simply by making sure that your society is open and free. Now, that doesn't mean that a suicide bomber should be able to dictate the agenda of society. And please don't think that I'm saying that. I'm not. I mean, look at what we did with Tim McVeigh. We hunted him down. We imprisoned him. We gave him a trial, and we executed him. And you know, Terry Nichols with him. I mean, he hasn't been executed, but we prosecuted him. And in doing so, what we did was we validated our ideals, and we invalidated his idea of America. By saying, okay, Tim McVeigh is a heinous criminal. He's done wrong. He's insane. And we're going to treat him like a criminal, like an insane criminal. I mean, who else would... Only an insane person would kill all these people like this, right? And we got it. The country got it. The world got it. Ah, this guy is sick. This guy's a criminal. Not this guy's a hero. So why is it or how is it that when another guy decides to blow up a building in the United States, we turn him into a hero? Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden was largely unknown in the Muslim world. He desperately wanted recognition. He thought that the Islamic world, all the various nations of the Islamic world, were going down the tubes. They were going to hell in a handbasket, morally, culturally, spiritually, and that the problem, the source of the problem, was American culture and American influence. And that we were enforcing that militarily, that we had our troops in Saudi Arabia, that we were corrupting all the other governments where we had troops, and he wanted us out. And so he hits the World Trade Center. And instead of responding by saying, this guy's a criminal, help us hunt him down, because we had the entire world with us the day that the World Trade Center got hit. I mean, Le Monde's headline, we are all Americans now. As candlelight vigils in the streets of Tehran, Iran. We had the world with us. And we could have said to the world, you know, look at the insanity of this fundamentalism. Just like we said, look at the insanity of Tim McVeigh. And we could have turned the world against the Islamic fundamentalists. But instead, George Bush had to have a war because he wanted that war because he thought it would give him political capital so he could get elected, he could get the Republicans in control, the House and Senate, and just it would just be the finest thing if he could have a war in Iraq. And so we used that. It was cynically used. It was cynically exploited. Bush cynically exploited that horrible tragedy, that crime, to turn it into a so-called war on terrorism. And the result Osama bin Laden got what Tim McVeigh wanted. He got notoriety, and he got and the heavy fist, the clamping down, brought about the response. The more people we kill in Iraq, the more suicide bombers there'll be. It's that simple. You kill somebody's brother-in-law, you kill their sister-in-law, you kill their family. You got 100,000 dead civilians in Iraq. How many of them have family? All of them! You think that there's not going to be generations of hatred against the United States from that? This is the fundamental insanity of the policy of the Bush administration. If he had simply followed, if he had responded to 9/11 the same way that Clinton responded to Tim McVeigh, we would not be in this mess. But George's only answer to anything was, oh, let's have a war. Why? Because he never went to war. He doesn't know the horrors of war. The only guy in the entire administration who understands the horrors of war, Colin Powell, saying, hey, wait a minute, you break it, you own it. Bush wouldn't listen. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Woo! Well, don't you know, baby? Child, don't you know, baby?
Don't you know?
Don't you know, baby?
And welcome back, my friends.
Girl, don't you know?
Yeah, don't you know? It's Carl Rove. That's who it is. It's 4 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Johnson, Michael Grimaldi, Brent Caven, all former CIA officers, all registered Republicans, giving testimony before the United States Senate, October 24, 2003. And I quote, "We also want to send a clear message to the political operatives responsible for outing Mrs. Wilson. Such action was treacherous, if not treasonous. Such action was taken with utter disregard for the dangerous times in which we all live. This has set a sickening precedent. The senior administration officials who did this have warned all U.S. intelligence officers in the intelligence community that any one individual may be compromised if providing information of factual analysis the White House does not like." They go on to say, "This was a deliberate political act intended to exact retribution for Joe Wilson's public expression of his views." They go on, this is from three registered Republican former CIA officers before the United States Senate, October 24, 2003. "We have seen craven partisan proxies, a junior congressman from Georgia, for example, used to continue the assault. The efforts to discredit Ambassador Wilson have included questioning his competence to conduct an investigation in Niger and suggesting that his wife's covert status is of little value because she's a low-level employee of the CIA. And if Wilson's comments or analysis have no merit, why does the White House feel the need to launch such a coordinated attack? Why drag his wife and family into it?" Good question. "In fact, Joe Wilson was our last ambassador, our last official envoy." He wasn't actually, it didn't hold the title of ambassador. It was like envoy or something like that, because we didn't have an ambassador to Iraq at the time of the war in 1991. "But just before we declared war on Iraq, Joe Wilson was there on behalf of George Herbert Walker Bush. Saddam Hussein came out and said he was going to hang all the Americans. Joe Wilson gathered them all together into the U.S. Embassy to hide them and protect them. And then he went out in front of the embassy with a piece of rope in his hand, made a noose out of it, put it around his neck and held it up, and for the television cameras called a press conference and said, 'Saddam Hussein, you want to hang Americans? Here I am. Come and get me.' And he backed down Saddam Hussein." That's Joe Wilson. Will he back down George W. Bush and Karl Rove? We'll see. This is a craven and cowardly act by George W. Bush and Karl Rove to cover up the fact that they were lying about the nuclear threat, the so-called nuclear threat that Saddam Hussein represented, and that they were lying us into a war, and Joe Wilson was telling the truth about it. I'm telling you, the Republicans are going to continue to try and tear down Joe Wilson in an attempt to keep their lies intact. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman radio program, Fair and Slightly Unbalanced. Talk radio for the rest of us. Oh, my. Yes, you heard it here first. Alec Dubrow is with the ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association. What would you call it? It's not a division of the AFL-CIO, Alec.
We call it an allied institute of AFL-CIO.
An allied institute. And you always have insightful thoughts on what's going on in the labor movement. I know you wanted to talk about the Free Choice Act and what's going on in New Jersey and with regard to that. Before we do, though, something passed by my desk yesterday or the day before. Just a short story went flying by that there was a member of Congress who had introduced a law that said that corporations will only be able to deduct from their taxes CEO and senior executive salaries equal to no more than 25 times the pay of the lowest paid employee in the company. Are you familiar with that?
I hadn't heard that. That sounds like a great idea. I think it'll pass in a whiz.
Yeah,
no,
right.
No problem.
Yeah, as long as the Republicans are in control. No, it's actually this piece of legislation was passed. I don't have the bill in front of me. I had just assumed, which is always a dangerous thing, I guess, that you would have known about it. I believe it was a member of Congress from New York State who introduced it. And, of course, it's, you know, with the Republicans in charge of the House of Representatives, it will go nowhere. But I think it's a great idea to say. And it's not to say that you can't pay your senior executives more than 25 times what your least lowly paid employee makes. You can pay them anything you want. You just can't deduct it from your taxes, from your corporate tax return. Right now, there's a $1 million limit on how much, you know, the CEO can be paid and deduct from their taxes.
Yeah. Well, Tom, you know, a million doesn't go as far as it used to. I feel their pain.
Especially if you're Bernie Ebbers. He's speaking of pain, he's looking at 25 years in jail. For those of you who hadn't heard the news, Bernard Ebbers was just convicted and given a 25-year sentence in the MCI WorldCom thing.
Well, sometimes justice is done. So
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So anyhow, the Employee Free Choice Act. What is this, Alec?
Okay, it's an attempt mostly by Democrats in Congress, with some Republican allies, to remedy the grave problem that workers have in the United States in trying to organize. And, you know, we visited this issue before, but we need to visit it again.
Well, let's just define the problem first. We have a situation where in the United States, the peak of unionization was the period between 1947 and 55.
Exactly.
Yeah, roughly that period of time where about 35% of all Americans had union jobs.
It reached its height at 35%.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that meant for every union job, typically there's another job that has the same pay because the union jobs set up a competitive floor. And so roughly 70% of American workers in that period of time could put their kids through school, put their children through college, have all their health care covered, have a pension for their retirement, be able to buy a house, be able to buy a car. It was the golden age of the American middle class. And then it started slowly creeping down, partly as a result of the 1947 Taft-Hartley law, which allowed states to opt out of the Wagner Act in some regards. But then it really picked up steam in 1980 when Ronald Reagan came in and declared war against the American worker. We had 25% of America unionized in 1980, and it's down to what now?
Now it's some 11%, 8.5% in the private sector. It's you know, it's a serious problem. It depresses wages and benefits all around. Now,
which harms the economy, by the way.
It harms the economy, as Henry Ford said when he was forced to pay workers more. Well, I guess I'd better. If I don't pay them, who are going to buy the cars?
Right, forced in part by his wife and his bookkeeper.
Exactly.
Interesting story there. And Ford, however, took credit for it once it worked.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And certainly the the depression in wages and benefits is not entirely due to anti-union activity. There's certainly other economic factors at play here. But that is the safeguard that workers have had, and that's the one that's so far under attack. Now, let me just read you this little quote from the executive director of the Human Rights Watch. Legal obstacles tilt the playing field so steeply against freedom of association that the United States is in violation of international human rights standards for workers. And it's that bad.
Wow.
Yes. And
now, is this all across the country, or is this just in some states?
Well, I mean, this is, he's essentially talking about federal law, how federal law is applied more than how federal law is written, and about the National Labor Relations Act, which was designed to protect workers against the inequality that workers have against employers. This was intended to provide a balance. Now the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is, in the words of the AFL-CIO, it's an obstacle, not a means to union representation. Mm-hmm. It's like a stacked deck of cards. You know, I mean, because so few people these days do belong to unions, few of them actually know what they have to do to join it. And it is anti-democratic. And just give me a minute, and I'll tell you what you have to do in order to join a union and why we needed this Employees Free Choice Act.
Okay, you have 6 minutes.
Okay, you want to join a union. You ask a union to represent you, or you create your own. You collect signatures from a majority of people at your workplace or in the company or even the industry at large. You have a majority. You go to the employer and you say, okay, a majority of us want to be represented by this entity. The employer says no or says nothing. And there's nothing you can do. You go to the National Labor Relations Board. You ask for an election. They set you an election. You've already had an election, but they set you an election. In the intervening time, which can be 30, 60, 90 days, the company can sequester employees for up to 2 hours a day to indoctrinate them.
Sequester?
Yes.
You mean like herd you into a room and say, if you leave, we're going to shoot you or fire you?
But they can't say they're going to fire you. They can do everything up to that point. They can intimidate you in any way possible. They can't literally say they're going to fire
they
you.
They can reduce your pay?
I don't know what they can say they can do, but they use every means possible to keep you in the room.
Right.
And, you know, it's very difficult to go against unified management at that point. They say, and they will do everything except threaten to fire you. And in addition to having group meetings, they can have one-on-one meetings with managers. And suppose that the majority of people the people who signed the cards resist this intimidation, and not too many of them do, and you win the election, the company can say, fine, great, you won the election, we're not going to bargain with you anyway. And the law says they have to, but they delay and they delay and they delay, and the people who started the union may drift away for one reason or another, and they can delay it so long that they weaken it. They call it decertification election, and they win it.
Or if they're in Canada and it's Walmart, they simply close the store.
Or they can, well, there are any number of extra legal tactics. They can certainly do that. They've closed store. Walmart closed the store here. They got rid of their meat cutting division because they voted to join a union.
That's right.
That's right. And what do they incur from the NLRB? They have to post a notice in the break room saying that they're in violation. There's no fine, no injunction, no nothing. So that the reason why union density reached its point, in part, was because that the government sided with the workers. This, as you point out, has happened increasingly, and since Reagan has turned from, you know, indifference to outright hostility. Here's an interesting thing I found. On the Republican Party platform, of 2004, it says, we affirm the time-honored right of individuals to voluntarily participate in labor organizations and to bargain collectively. It then goes on for 6 paragraphs to explain why this shouldn't be true in the cases that they cite. But, you know, that's what they say. What they've actually done is stack the NLRB with anti-union activists.
Yeah. So the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yes. That's an intended to remedy it. That Ted Kennedy and Republican Arlen Specter introduced it in the Senate, and a Democrat and Republican in the House. And what it would do would provide certification for union elections where you simply file a majority of cards. it would just, you, if you have a majority of workers, your union is certified. It would also provide fines and penalties if the employer refuses to bargain in good faith with you. And this is really good. I mean, this is fair. This is, in fact, what an election should be. Majority rules in the workplace, just as it does in the country. You know,
we're talking about democracy in the workplace here.
That is exactly what we're talking about. You know, you can't opt out of the country, although I would like to at times, because the majority says they vote for a particular policy. That's the way it is, you're part of it. But here, you know, the law, and particularly the Republican-driven law, has given people it's thrown, as the British say, thrown a spanner in the works. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So this law under this Congress is probably not going to pass. Were it to pass, this president most certainly would not sign it. But some states are taking actions, and New Jersey did. And they have a law that's just about to become finalized, and the acting governor said he would sign it, which would cover those workers who are not right now covered and allow for majority checkoff. In other words, if they file a majority cards, they would have their union certified there. But, you know, they still have to deal with the federal law in a lot of cases. States can take action. Nevertheless, you know, what we need is a groundswell of support for the Employee Free Choice Act.
How do we get that, Alec?
I'm sorry?
How do we get that, Alec?
Well, you know, you do as you do with any lobbying. You call your elected representative, unless you're like me and don't have one and live in the District of Columbia. But let's say most people do. Call them and make sure, A, if they support it, to support it even more. And if they don't, ask them why and demand some action here.
And you can call your
fairness.
Right. And you can call your senators, both of your senators, and you can call your representative, your member of Congress, toll-free by calling 1-877-SOB-USOB. The letters SOB, the letter USOB. It's the old Senate Office Building phone number, and it's the toll-free. They don't publish it. They don't advertise it, but we found it, and it's real, and it really does work. You can call toll-free from anywhere in the United States. You'll get the Capitol switchboard, 1-877-SOB-USOB. And if you don't know the name of your member of Congress, you can simply give them your zip code, and they'll tell you who it is. And they'll then put you through to the office of that person. And then you say, I want you to support the Employee Free Choice Act. This thing needs to come to the floor of the House, the floor of the Senate. It needs a vote. It needs to pass. Right?
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, great. Alec DeBrow, he's with the ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org is their website. Alec, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, thanks for having me. Tom.
Okay, we'll talk to you again. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It is time for...
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, indeed. The director of Tom Delay's Political Action Committee is going to be facing felony charges. How much longer can the corrupt House leader survive politically? The former director of House Majority Leader Tom Delay's fundraising organization... A judge ruled Tuesday should stand trial on felony charges of money laundering. Yes, money laundering. This is the Tom DeLay's buddy, the guy who's in charge of his political action committee. The LA Times reports that Travis County District Judge Bob Perkins, good old Bob down there in Travis County, Texas, rejected a request by John Colyandro to throw out an indictment charging him with money laundering and accepting illegal campaign contributions. Perkins also indicated that he thought a second indicted DeLay associate, GOP political consultant and fundraiser James Ellis, should also stand trial. Tom DeLay on the edge. On the edge here. This report from the American Progress, the Center for American Progress, by the way, the stem cells, Arlen Specter is really moving this thing up. A lot of folks have noticed that Senator Specter is getting bald, or is bald. It's from chemotherapy. And he is, of course, one of the people who's enthusiastic about stem cells because they offer the possibility, stem cell research offers the possibility of curing the very kind of cancer that Senator Specter has. So the Republican Senator Specter and the Democrat Tom Harkin yesterday said, quote, Congress must first pass legislation to lift President Bush's restrictions on embryonic stem cell research before paying for unproven alternative methods, end quote. The Center for American Progress notes, scientists involved in developing the alternatives agree. Robert Lanza, who is developing one of the alternatives, called any choice between the Specter-Harkin bill and a conservative alternative that might fund his own studies a no-brainer, said Lanza. I do not think we should keep the scientific community or the patient community waiting. Now, you get it. This is a guy who stands to profit off making available alternatives to stem cells. Alternatives to stem cell research. Well, there's a variety of other ways to do things. You know, there's a lot of different ways to skin a cat, and everybody's looking at variations on this particular one. And this is a guy who will make money off alternatives to stem cells, and he's saying it would be crazy for you to not move ahead with stem cell research at the same time. Just makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, is it just a certain level of, gee, this is rational? Rational, of course, is not the absolute hallmark of this administration. In fact, here now, this is from the Associated Press. Speaking of rational, keep in mind our forests, the forests of our country, are the kidneys of our country. They filter our water. They hold our soil. A federal appeals court dismissed an attempt by environmental groups to restore a Clinton-era ban on logging in roadless areas of national forests, saying their appeal became irrelevant. When? What made their appeal irrelevant? Here you had laws in place, policies in place, roadless areas being protected, saying, hey, there are some parts of this country that simply should stand separate, where it historically has been pristine country and territory. We're going to leave it that way. Became irrelevant when the Bush administration adopted a replacement rule. The Bush administration comes along and they say, we're going to change the rules. Roadless areas, we don't need those stinking roadless areas. We got lumber companies that contribute to our campaign. And they see a dollar in those forests, they want to make some money. And as long as they're contributing to Republicans, you can forget about your forests. The Clinton administration's rule put 58.5 million acres of roadless forest off limits to logging and other development. Under the new rule, those lands, most of which are in the West, are open to road building for potential logging, mining, and other commercial uses. Wrong. Terribly wrong thing. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Someone should have told me. Someone should have warned. So I wouldn't have been blinded by the power of that storm.
And welcome back. Yeah, Karl Rove's official song now. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Welcome back to the program. I think it's important to just take an overview of this thing. This whole Joe Wilson, Karl Rove. First of all, get it. Get it, that what really is going on here is that George Bush was lying us into war. He was lying to us about the threat that Saddam Hussein represented. He was aggressively lying to us about it, and in a whole variety of ways. For example,
first, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons.
While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And when he said that, he knew that it was a lie. He just absolutely knew that it was a lie. He also knew that if he could convince us of that, or he believed that if he could convince us of that, he would get enough political capital that the Republicans would win the election of 2002, of November 2002, that the Republicans, you know, they would take back control of the Senate because they had lost control of the Senate when one of their own, Republican Jim Jeffords of Vermont, said, "That's it. That's enough. This party has changed so much it doesn't I can't recognize it anymore. I'm leaving," and became an independent. He didn't become a Democrat. He became an independent. And it threw control of the Senate to the Democrats. And the Republicans were then just absolutely freaked out. They were trying to get their Patriot Act through. What are we going to do? Well, you know, fortuitously, there was an anthrax attack that just happened to hit the two guys who were roadblocks to the Patriot Act, Pat Leahy of Vermont, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, through whom the Patriot Act had to pass, and Tom Daschle, who was the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. And fortuitously, just by coincidence, those are the only two guys who got any anthrax. And so the Patriot Act got passed, and Bush got his political capital, and he got a little more control of the levers of government. And he figured he had to have his war to have political capital so he could get himself elected in 2004 for the first time. And we can talk about that. I mean, that's a whole other discussion, the fact that the exit polls show that he didn't win, the machines show that he did. But nonetheless, he would credit the war in Iraq, and Karl Rove certainly would credit the war in Iraq with giving him the political capital to have won that election. But he had to lie us into it.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
And Joe Wilson came along and said, well, you may think he has weapons of mass destruction. You may think he represents a threat. But I'm telling you, I checked it out, and certainly he's not buying any uranium from Niger. It's a lie. And Joe Wilson writes an op-ed about it in the New York Times. Well, Bush is in the middle of aggressively trying to lie us into a war. He is trying to scare the bejesus out of us so that we'll all be terrified and we'll say, okay, George, you go start your war and you can be the great warrior president and you can land on an aircraft carrier and walk around with that sock stuffed in there and all that kind of stuff. And we're going to salute you and just think it's just absolutely great and elect you, and we'll get the Republicans in, and they'll lock up the House, and they'll lock up the Senate, and they won't hold any hearings on any kind of crimes. We'll stack the House Ethics Committee. You go, George. They were aggressively George Bush at the behest of Karl Rove. I mean, this was clearly a strategy that Karl Rove laid out. You have Tom Ridge, the guy who was the director of Homeland Security, coming out after the election, after he's resigned, in public, saying to the media, to the press, that he had not asked for all those increased terror alerts that ran up to the election. Remember, every time the Bush administration got in trouble, every time some story came out that reflected poorly on George Bush, all of a sudden the terror alert would jump up. And that would become the story, and the news cycle would change, and the story that was a bad story for George would vanish from the front pages, because if you can't sustain a story for 24 hours in the news cycle, it's toast. And you got Tom Ridge saying, I don't know why the administration kept saying, you got to raise the terror alert. It was Karl Rove. He was engineering the whole thing. It's why they haven't raised the terror alert once for the entire nation since the election. The terror that they were afraid of was John Kerry. He had the very real possibility of beating George Bush. That terrorized Bush. He had to raise the terror alert. Every time it looked like John Kerry might win, raise the terror alert. So here he is, he's trying to lie us into a war. He's trying to scare us into a war. Trying to convince us that we should attack a country that represented no threat to us, whose Air Force we had bombed into smithereens, who had no Navy, whose army was a ragtag bunch of conscripts, most of them 15 years old, who had no weapons of any consequence, that he knew that we could quickly defeat. I mean, he was going to try and do what Ronald Reagan did in Grenada. You knock over a little country that's easily knocked over, and you get all kinds of political capital. Everybody thinks you're wonderful. And, in fact, Bush was right. We defeated Saddam Hussein very quickly. Took just a couple of weeks. Bang! We're in Baghdad. The invasion was successful. When Bush declared mission accomplished on the invasion on the deck of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, he was right. He had led a successful invasion. Problem was, now we had the country, we broke it. That's what armies do. Armies are all about breaking things. Sometimes it's absolutely necessary. I'm not saying that as a criticism of armies. I'll tell you, people in the military will tell you the first thing, what they're trained to do is kill people and blow things up. And there are times when you need an army that is very competent at killing people and blowing things up. It's how we stopped Hitler. But what armies are not adept at is rebuilding countries, putting things back together. The Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe, we didn't do it with the army. We did do it with government agencies, but that's a whole other thing. So anyhow, Bush is aggressively trying to lie us into a war.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
See, these are the clips that the Bush administration does not want being played. This is the discussion they don't want going on in the media. They want there to be a discussion about Karl Rove versus Joe Wilson. Not a discussion about Joe Wilson versus George Bush. Because that's what really was going on here. George Bush was lying to us, and Joe Wilson pointed it out. Uday Hussein had some model airplanes. He had a model airplane with a wingspan of about 12 feet, a little gasoline engine on it, and a little hangar. His toy. I don't know if it was that the Department of Defense had a photo of it from outer space or whether it was Ahmed Chalabi, but somebody took this thing to George Bush and said, "Look at this! They're going to attack America with this!" And Bush said, "Well, give me a break. But, hey, I can use this in my speech."
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Say, be afraid, America. Be very afraid. This was the message coming out of George W. Bush over and over and over. And it was a lie. And it was a conscious lie. It was an intentional lie. It was a lie that he was planning in 1999 when he talked with his biographer, the guy who ghost wrote his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, and said, if I get a chance to invade Iraq, I'm going to use the political capital, unlike his father. He figured that if his father had not stopped at the border of Iraq and said, let's have a 100-day war and minimize the bloodshed, if his father instead had gone all the way to Baghdad, that his father would have gotten reelected against Bill Clinton. And I think he was right. I think if George Bush Sr. had gone all the way to Baghdad, he probably would have won that presidential election campaign against Bill Clinton. Problem is, the United States would have been in a Vietnam-like situation for the next 20 years. And the Middle East could have been in flames. And that was George Bush Sr.'s point. That's why he sent he had Brent Scowcroft write a piece for the New York Times before we invaded Iraq, telling Junior, on behalf of Senior, please don't invade Iraq. But no, George Bush had to lie his way into the war. He had to tie it to 9/11, even though there was no link. And he had to scare us as completely as he could, and Joe Wilson was not letting him do it. Joe Wilson stood in the way. Joe Wilson was an appointee of his father. Joe Wilson, the last major diplomat that we had in Baghdad, just before the attacks, just before the Gulf War started, after Saddam Hussein had attacked Kuwait, And George Bush Sr. started saying, okay, that's it, we're going to come and get you, get out of Kuwait. And Saddam Hussein came out and he said he was going to arrest and hang all the Americans. Joe Wilson is running the U.S. Embassy then. And he goes out and he gathers up all the Americans in Baghdad and hides them in the embassy, protects them. And then he goes out in the street with a rope, puts it around his neck, calls together the TV cameras and says, okay, Saddam, here I am, come and hang me. You want an American? Here I am. As an employee of George Bush Sr., Joe Wilson, the ambassador, the guy that these cons are trying to tear down. Meanwhile, this is the guy, right? And so now we're back in, here we are, 2002, George Bush trying to lie us into a war, and Joe Wilson, the thing that stands between them and their war. Joe Wilson being taken seriously because he's an ambassador. Joe Wilson being taken seriously, a former ambassador, because he was the nation's last major diplomat in Baghdad. Joe Wilson being taken seriously because he knows Africa. He was an ambassador in Africa. Joe Wilson being taken seriously because he worked for Bush Sr. He knew Bush Sr. Joe Wilson had to be taken out because he could puncture the balloon of lies that George Bush was trying to peddle to America.
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons.
There you go.
If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. They've got unmanned aerial vehicles. They got Uday Hussein's balsa wood airplane. And they might attack the United States with it. You never know. Maybe they've got in-flight refueling model airplanes, too. And they got people stationed all the way, you know, a continuous line of them every mile or so, all the way from Baghdad to New York City. They're on floating platforms across the Atlantic with little remote control things for those model airplanes. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Bush's message to America. And Joe Wilson saying, there's nothing to be afraid of. This guy's lying to you. And daring to say it in the New York Times. I'm telling you, this is what I'm sharing with you right now. This is the discussion that the right wing is going to do absolutely everything they can to make sure it doesn't happen. They're going to make it all about Joe Wilson so that nobody will talk about George Bush.
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people. Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
Notice Bush talking about 9/11 right after he talks about Saddam Hussein. Be afraid, nuclear!
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
So let's just get it right up front. What this is all about is that Joe Wilson had the audacity, the temerity, the courage, in my viewpoint, but you know, not from the Bush administration's viewpoint. How dare he to point out that they were telling us lies? That George Bush was lying to us, that Dick Cheney was lying to us, that Don Rumsfeld was lying to us, that Colin Powell was uncomfortable, squirming, pulling at his collar on his shirt, and after a large gulp and swallow lying to us, that they were all lying to us. And they were lying to us about something that was going to ultimately lead to the death of 1,700, more than that, of over 1,700 of our young men and women, and over 100,000 innocent civilians in Iraq, not to mention those Iraqis who would stand up and try to fight for their country and throw off an invader, what they perceived as an invader. And Joe Wilson stood up and said, no, I'm sorry, this is a lie, Mr. Bush. You are lying to the American people. It's not true. He had to be taken out. And now he's going to, you know, they got to take him out again because it's coming back around. Karl Rove went in and apparently lied to the grand jury. Said he didn't talk to the press until after Bob Novak's column came out. And now it's obvious from Matt Cooper's emails that he was running around trying to peddle his story to anybody who would listen. And, of course, the only one who was enough of a sleaze to run it was Bob Novak. And keep in mind, this is not the first time that Karl Rove has leaked something to Bob Novak. You know, back in the 1980 campaign of George Bush Sr. against Bill Clinton, Bob Novak took a leak from Karl Rove about Karl Rove's competitor for the Bush administration's direct mail business in the campaign. And Bush Sr. fired Karl Rove because he had leaked this information to Bob Novak in 1980. So it's not like Bush wouldn't have known what was going on. They're going to, I'm telling you, just watch. They're going to make it all about Joe Wilson because they don't want it to be about George Bush's lies. And that's the prize you need to keep your eye on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hooroo, hooroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, hooroo, hooroo. With your guns and drums and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew you. My darling dear, you look so queer. Johnny, I hardly knew you.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Congressman Peter King. Now, here's a guy who has, shall we say, audacity. Just before the 2004 election, the day before the election, this in a videotape that Nancy Pelosi's daughter made. Congressman Peter King, he's at a party in New York. He's fairly drunk. And she says, who do you think is going to win the election, and what's going on with the election? And he says something to the effect of, and you can find this video all over the web, he says something to the effect of, it's all over except the counting, and we're taking care of that. Peter King, on TV on Scarborough Country, last night, the right-wing talk show, King says, the media who gave Ambassador Joe Wilson such a free ride, they're the ones to be shot. Congressman Peter King threatening members of the press, saying that they should be put to death, justifying the treasonous leak of classified information by Karl Rove, and saying that the media should be shot. He says, maybe Karl Rove was not perfect, but we live in an imperfect world, and I give him credit for having the guts. The guts! It is just absolutely incredible. Today, the Karl Rove whistleblower, the headline on today's, the lead editorial in today's Wall Street Journal. They're reinventing Karl Rove as the hero. King was talking about, he's to the Washington Post, he says, Republicans should stop holding back and go on the offense, fire enough bullets the other way until the Supreme Court nomination overtakes the Rove story. Well, that's what they're doing. It's absolutely what they're doing. Peter King in New York State. If you don't like what Peter King has to say about this, particularly if you live in New York State, give him a call and let him know. You can reach him at 1-877-SOB-USOB. That's the toll-free number for Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB. And you can let Peter King know what you think of his comments, that members of the press should be shot, and that Karl Rove is a hero. I know I'll be letting him know what I think. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. Thanks to Scott for engineering our program, to Louise for producing it, to you for listening. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Great to see you all there here today. And the folks participating in our blog. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.